We should be really grateful that we're women, because we had some lovely examples of women down through history who've persevered against the odds and been incredible women. And even the dear old Queen Mother, who could, this week stand and say, God bless you over her nation. What an amazing thing to be able to do that over your nation. Well, each of you are women who can, over your families, over your communities, and over your nations, proclaim God bless you and bring blessing to your community. What a wonderful thing to be a woman of God. And God created you for intimacy. Intimacy in relationship with Him. Intimacy in relationship with your partner, your husband. Intimacy in relationship with your children, and then with your friends and the wider world. And the thing that has ruined that intimacy, of course, is sin. Sin ruins intimacy. It broke it way back with Adam and Eve in the garden, and it tries to destroy it with us in our personal relationships between us and God. If our hearts have hardened up, it's usually because of sin. Between us and our partners, between us and our children, between us and our family members, between us and our church family, and between us and our neighbourhood. The thing that breaks intimacy is sin. And we have to be quick to put a nip on the sin and get rid of it, find out what it is, so that we live in open communication with God all the time, always loving God, always knowing we're loved. And open communication with our husband, always loving our husband, always knowing we're loved. We made a rule in our marriage. I read it in a book when I was about 15, one of those. It was called the Trudy series, and Trudy did this and Trudy did that, and I thought they were fabulous. And one of the things Trudy did was, one of the verses was, she never let the sun go down on her wrath when she got married. And I remembered that. And when we got married, Bruce and I decided we would never let the sun go down on our wrath. Now, there's been some times when I've been lying in that bed and I've been pretty cross and I've been thinking, not let the sun go down on my wrath, hey? Well, it's his turn to say sorry. I am blinking sick of saying sorry and being the repentant one. But then as the hours wear on in the night and I can't sleep and God won't let me sleep and the verse comes back, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. And I know I cannot let it go to the next day. And so I'll just put my hand out rather grudgingly. I love you, dear. And do you know the minute that I grudgingly, in all my anger and whatever, go, I'll be obedient if it kills me. Immediately, his heart softens and immediately we cuddle up and we go to sleep. And often he will do it for me too, so we do it to each other. And usually it just depends which of us is more closer to God, who can humble ourselves and say sorry. Or even if we don't think we've done wrong, I'm sorry for the sin that's come between us. And God will honour that and break the barrier. And it doesn't matter who it is in your life that that is happening with. If you can say, God, I'm willing to forgive, I'm willing to say sorry, then God will be able to restore your relationships with the world and you will be able to be a woman of God. And the other, that was what we've looked at, and the other thing we've looked at is the pace of modern life, and that if we don't take rest and time to sort out who we are and our priorities and who we are in terms of our relationships and take rest, then we're not going to make it. And Glenys, I think it was this morning, who said to me that that's a very good point, and I can't see Glenys, she's here somewhere, but she said it's a good point, you know, to have your roles worked out and to love God first and your husband next and your children next. But if you've been doing that for 20 years and then your children start leaving home or your husband dies or something terrible happens, what happens then? And that's a very true thing. That's a very true thing. That's the grief of being a woman and being intimately connected to the world. And you'll all have been through stages, some of you where your children have left home and there's a grief there. We have to accept the grief of leaving. Or where terrible things have happened and maybe partners have left and we can't get them back and there is no mending and we're left. And relationships take two to mend, and you'll all know that that's a grievous thing. And I'm going through the stage where my children are going to be leaving home very soon and they're already showing signs of moving out, and I have to accept that. And God's been doing some stripping processes in my life over the last couple of years and gradually stripping some things that I love off. And he might be stripping you too. But you know, if you've got that first relationship right, if you've got the God part right, then the rest, no matter how hard and no matter the grief of being a woman and feeling this intimacy, which you might notice, even though the men are wonderful, they may not feel it the same. They can get up the next day and, you know, they can go on, but where? Oh, so grieved. But if you know where to run, the name of the Lord is a strong tower, the righteous run in and find shelter. If you know who loves you and you know where to run, then even in the dark valleys, God will be with you. And even in the unmendable bits, God will carry you and you will survive the process of parting and grieving. So yes, all those relationships are going to change over life. That's the nature of being mothers and being wives and women and growing old. Life changes, it doesn't stay the same. But if we know that our core being is to worship God and live with him forever, then we don't lose our sense of worth and value and significance. If our significance is being a mother, then we'll lose that when they start to move out or when things happen. If our significance is being the church leader and the busy lady, then when, you know, that church changes or things happen and we lose our place and our significance, then we're going to be crushed. But if we know we're a child of God, a woman of God, and if that never changes, that's not going to change till the day we die and then we're going to be with him. No one can take God from you. No one can take that relationship from you. You have to know who you are in God first. Today we're going to have a look at another woman in Scripture, another cameo, and I want you to turn to Luke chapter 7. And this is another woman who doesn't have a name. And we're going to read from verse 36, Luke chapter 7 and verse 36. Now one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him, so he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. When a woman who had lived a sinful life in that town learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house, she bought an alabaster jar of perfume, and as she stood behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. And then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner." And Jesus answered him, "Simon, I have something to tell you." "Tell me, teacher," he said. "Two men owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 500 denarii and another 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he cancelled the debts of both. Now which of them will love him more?" And Simon replied, "I suppose the one who had the bigger debt cancelled." "You have judged correctly," Jesus said. Then he turned toward the woman and said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman from the time I entered has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, for she loved much. But he who has been forgiven little loves little." And Jesus said to her, "Your sins are forgiven." And the other guests began to say among themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" And Jesus said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." Okay, so here we have a woman who doesn't have a name. She comes in, Jesus is having dinner at the house of Simon the Pharisee. And there's all these people there, and this woman comes in. She stoops behind him at his feet, and her tears wash his feet, and with her hair she dries his feet. and she lowers herself before him. And this is a picture to us of a woman who doesn't really care what other people think. Doesn't really care what other people think. In contrast, Simon, the guy who'd invited Jesus to dinner, he cared a lot. And he looked and he was disgusted. This woman, and this woman of all people, some places she's described as a harlot or a woman of the town. This woman didn't have a good reputation. She had strikes against her, a bit like the other woman that we've looked at. And Simon was disgusted that Jesus would even let her touch him. Fancy letting a woman like that touch him. Imagine if in those days our legal eagle from last night, whose name I can't remember, was there. Surely there would have been, you know, some case taken up against Jesus. I mean, he was associating with people that didn't have a good reputation. And in these days, if you don't want to ruin your ministry, don't be seen with a harlot. In a man, you could lose your ministry, you could lose your reputation. It's a terrible thing. Jesus didn't care about that because he saw the woman's heart. Simon cared a lot about that. He thought it was terrible. And he started to have doubts about Jesus. He thought, well, maybe this guy isn't a prophet, because if he was a prophet, he would have known what sort of a woman this was. You see, Jesus came for the sinners. He didn't come for the righteous. He came for the sinners. He came for those of us who know that we don't make it, that we miss the mark. And Jesus appreciated her heart, because she came in and she washed his feet and she cared about him and she knelt before him and she showed him her love and her reverence. And she did it in front of a whole lot of people. Now, we might be horrified at that. The interesting thing in that passage is that Simon doubted. He didn't actually speak, and Jesus answered him. Gee, doesn't that scare you a bit? If you're really honest, doesn't that, you know, sort of worry you a little bit? I mean, it's all very well for Psalm 139 to say that God knows everything about us, the hairs on our head and, you know, the days of our lives and each season of our life, and yes, God, you can know everything about me, that is fine, because on the outside I don't look too bad. You know, I hold it together normally quite well. But now Jesus is reading his thoughts. And I don't know about you, sometimes my thoughts aren't so good. And Jesus is answering this guy's thoughts and he's saying, you know, he's replying to his thoughts. And that gets down to the very heart of us inside. And that challenges me, because haven't I sometimes looked at people when they're worshipping God and thought, gee, they're going a bit over the top there. I wish they'd calm it down a bit. It's not my style. I was raised conservative. I was a good brethren girl. And, you know, we didn't do things that way. Well, maybe Jesus can read my thoughts too. And, you know, it's hard for us to understand that God hates more our proud eyes and our haughty looks and our stuck-up ways and our thinking we're good. He hates that more than he hates the prostitute's sin or the harlot's sin or the murderer's sin, because what he hates is that we don't recognise our need. And I think that's for most of us. And you know, women, the higher you go up in the Christian church system, the higher you go up in leadership, and the more jobs you do, and the more you're the upfront person or the women's leader or whatever it is that you do in your little world, the harder it is to admit that actually you're just a woman who needs God, and you do stuff wrong and you think stuff wrong and you're a sinner. And if we want to be close to God, we've got to every day admit that we don't get it right, and we've got to keep short accounts with God. And we've got to shut our haughty eyes to what other people are doing and stop judging and pointing the finger and wishing other people were different. And we've got to say, as Psalm 139 says, which was our theme for the weekend, search me, O God, me, here, me. search me and know my heart. See if there is any wicked way in me and lead me in the way everlasting. It's me, God, sitting in front of you. And I need you to search me. Knowing God and being intimate with God is a very, very difficult thing, and nobody talks about it much. We all know how to play church. You just go and you join everything and you do some things well, and someone will ask you to do something and you'll get a job, and then you'll get a better job and a better job and a better job, and if you run fast enough, you'll eventually get to the top of the tree or something like that. I don't mean that quite as callously as it sounds. But you know what I mean. We can all play church. But can we be God's women? That's the question. My husband and I have the privilege of facilitating youth pastors and leaders prayer summits. We've been doing that for about 4 years. And this year we did one in Melbourne and one in Perth, one in Brisbane. And at each of those, we gather together the leaders of youth in churches in that area. And we spend 4 days not asking God for anything, not praying about our ministries, but seeking God's faith. Now, you would think that for pastors and leaders of God's church, that would be an easy thing to do. But I can tell you that it's very hard. Because most of us, when we start, we don't even know how to do it. We don't even know where to begin. And I remember a couple of years ago in Melbourne, we were at this prayer summit and we were all just focusing in on God, and suddenly this one youth pastor shouted out and he said, "I am so frustrated. I've been sitting here for 2 days. And you guys have been going on about how wonderful it is to be in God's presence and about how great it is and how rich it is. And I just feel empty and barren. And my heart is cold. And I don't want to even be here. And I wish I could leave, but I can't. And I don't know what to do with my heart. And I'm sick of this whole church thing. I love God and I want to serve him, but I don't know God. I don't know God." And he was weeping. And actually, all of us in the circle didn't know what to do with him. Because how do you help someone know God? I mean, how do you do it? And so we did the only thing we know how. James 5:6 says, "If anybody is sick, is anybody in distress, pray for them. And the prayer of a righteous man does great things. Because God hears and answers prayer." So what we did was we just left him where he was, and we all gathered round him and we all cried out to God and we all said, "Oh God, we don't know you either. We don't know how to touch you, but this man is empty and barren and tired and he's sick of it. Will you do something with his heart?" And then we finished praying and we went off, and that was the end of the session. And about 2 sessions later, he said, "Oh, I can't describe to you. The love, it's back. I love God again. It's back. I love God. And I'm happy. And I can feel the joy of the Lord. And thank you, thank you, thank you." And we all thought, "Oh, God, you're so wonderful." And suddenly from the other end of the room came this yell. And this other youth pastor said, "Well, now I'm angry." Because while you weren't feeling right with God, and he pointed at this guy, while you weren't feeling right with God and you were hard and you were cold, it was okay for me to be hard and cold. And now you're all right, where does that leave me? And now we've been here for 3.5 days and I still don't know God. And I mean, these guys, it's funny when you hear about it, but these guys were like, this is their life's work. To lead people to God. This is there. And they've been so busy and they've been discipling people and telling people about Jesus. And when they come and sit at his feet, they suddenly realise, the heart is dried up. The heart. Have you ever felt like your heart's drying up? Oh, I've felt that sometimes. Oh, that's the worst feeling in the world. Where you feel like, God, where did my heart go? I used to grieve and weep and mourn and love you. Where did my heart go? Whew, that's a hard one. So what did we do with this second guy? We did exactly the same thing. First of all, we all went, oh no, what do we do now? And my husband and I particularly went, oh no, what do we do now? But God is what we do now. We did exactly the same thing. We prayed for him. And I can't remember whether he actually broke through to God on that 4 days or not. But he was grateful for the prayer. We have to be honest with each other about the condition of our hearts. And then we have to be honest with God. And then we have to cry out to God that he would do something with our hard hearts. Because otherwise we live empty, unfulfilled, playing church type lives. And it's awful. It's awful. And we don't have the living water that the woman at the well has. And we don't have the obedience that Esther had. And we don't have the humility that the lady who broke her jar had. When that lady broke her jar, the perfume filled all the house. And Jesus looked at her and he spoke to her and he said, "My peace I give to you." Oh, wouldn't you love Jesus to look at you and say, "My peace I give to you." He offers it to us. Sometimes I feel like I'm more in pieces than at peace. But Jesus offers us peace, the peace of God, the peace that passes all understanding, the peace that's now written on my friend's face that I told you about the other day. Peace of God. That's what we need in our lives. Peace. Not prosperity, peace. Let's turn to Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 10. Ah, no, before we do, I left out one very important passage. Let's turn to 2 Samuel. And then we'll go to Hebrews. 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 16. Actually, we'll go back a little bit further. We'll go back to verse 14. David was bringing the Ark of the Lord, which in those days symbolised the presence of God, back to the city of David. And David had already had a bit of a bad thing happen when he was doing this, what he thought was a good thing for God, bringing the Ark of the Lord back to the city of David. He thought he was doing a good thing, but he didn't follow exactly the instructions of God. And in the process of the Ark being put on a cart, and carried back to the city, one of the guys nearby had reached out and touched it and been struck dead because he'd gone against the commands of the Lord. And of course David had been really aghast at that because he thought he was doing a good thing bringing back the Ark of the Lord to the city. And so he actually left the Ark at the household of Obed-Edom. And because he saw that after 3 months the household was blessed, he went down and brought up the Ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with great rejoicing. So now we're up to verse 13. And David is so delighted because he's bringing back the Ark of the Lord and he sees that now the blessing is back on what he's doing. And this time he's got those carrying the Ark in the appropriate way. And so he's rejoicing before God. And in verse 14, David, wearing a linen ephod, danced before the Lord with all his might, while he and the entire house of Israel brought up the Ark of the Lord with shouts and with the sound of trumpets. As the Ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. Oh, that's really a heavy verse. She despised him. She was jealous, I think. She didn't want everybody else looking at her husband like that. She was jealous of his love for the Lord. Verse 17, they brought the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. After he had finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. And he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person in the whole crowd of Israelites, both men and women. And all the people went to their homes. And then David goes home to bless his household. Oh, for a man like that who's coming home to bless his household, wouldn't you be rejoicing if you're a wife? He's coming home, he's just blessed the nation. Now he's coming home to bless the household. All of us women want men who'll bless their household. Oh dear, but what was Michael's reaction? And when he returned to bless his household, Michael, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, disrobing in the sight of the slave girls of his servants, as any vulgar fellow would." And David said to Michael, "It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honour." And Michal, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. "I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in front of the Lord." That's what David said. He didn't care what his wife thought, because he was doing it for the Lord. He wasn't showing off. And some of our worship can be showing off, and there's passages in Scripture about that too, about not being the showy person, saying, "Look what I can do, how I can dance and do great things." And someone over here is beating their breast, and Jesus says, whose offering is more acceptable? The one who's beating their breast. So I'm not talking about showy stuff. I'm not talking about the party and the religious trimmings that we just have on for the sake of it. I'm talking about your heart. And the message here is God was obviously not pleased with this girl because she didn't bear any children. And I'm sure her life was never the same because she despised what someone did before the Lord. Gee, that challenges my heart. I go, "Oh God, when did I last despise or haughty eye something that someone else was doing out of their broken heart before God?" We have to be so careful with what we judge and what we think about others, because in the end, Jesus is the judge. Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 22. Actually, we'll start at verse 19. And this, ladies, is the secret. If you want to know how to tune up your heart, you know how we tune up the engine of a car, or we fix the dial on the radio so that we can get a clearer picture? Not a picture on a radio, sorry. Clear a sound on a radio and you tune it. This is the clue. Okay, therefore brothers, Hebrews chapter 10 verse 19, "Therefore brothers, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus." You know, we were just worshipping Jesus at the beginning of this session. We were honouring Jesus. Because of that Jesus, we have confidence to enter the most holy place by a new and living way opened for us through the curtain, that is his body. And since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near to God. And how do we draw near to God? With a sincere heart, in full assurance of faith, and with our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience. A sincere heart. No double-mindedness, no hypocrisy, no pretending. You know, sometimes we pretend before people and we pretend before God, but remember how Jesus could read their thoughts? It's pretty pointless pretending, because Jesus sees through it. He sees the heart. He sees the whole lot. So we have to be really careful that our hearts are sincere, and we have to take steps to draw near to God. You know, the lovely thing about drawing near to God is that at the very first step you take back towards God, The Father is waiting, just like the story in the prodigal son. The Father is waiting, running halfway down the road, ready for you, waiting for you to come, waiting for you to turn back and say, oh, okay, God, I've been hard and distant, I've been busy, I've been just trying to do it all myself. And now I just want to come back to you. And there's God waiting. Remember that verse in Revelation where Jesus says, I stand at the door of your heart, and I knock. He wasn't speaking to non-Christians, he was speaking to the church. I stand at the door and I knock. And if anyone will open the door, I will come in and sup with him. Wouldn't you like to sup with Jesus? Well, you just have to open the door of your heart. You have to say, okay, God, enough, enough. I heard you the first time. I'm not going to be hard anymore. I give up on that sin that keeps crippling me. Forgive me, cleanse me. I give up on that bitter attitude. I'm not going to let that attitude that I have to that person choke me any longer. And I'm going to forgive that person. And you know what? You don't have to have, I'm not talking about emotion, you don't have to have the emotion to forgive. It's a step of will and obedience. So if there's something in your heart that you cannot do, you do not have to have the nice feelings. You just have to say, God, out of obedience to you, as a woman of God, and because you ask me to forgive those who've done wrong against me so that I can receive your forgiveness, I forgive such and such. The emotions and the feelings may follow later, they may not. It's your obedience and your attitude of heart. So we need to have sincere hearts, no hypocrisy. We need to have full faith. What is our faith in? Our faith in is a God that is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Verse 6 of chapter 11 in Hebrews says, and without faith it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. Do you really believe that God rewards those who earnestly seek him? I do. We need to believe that God, that what he says in his word is true, that he is the rewarder of those who earnestly seek him. We need to be women who have sincere hearts, full faith, and then hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience. And how do we get our hearts sprinkled from sin? Well, first of all, we have to recognise the sin. One of the things I'm amazed at school is that kids who know nothing about God have never been to church. I shouldn't be amazed, but they know when they've done wrong. So I was sitting with a little 14-year-old who'd had an abortion, and she was weeping in my office, and I said to her, what makes you feel so bad? And she said, well, because I've done the wrong thing. And knowing that she had no church background, I said to her, how do you know you've done the wrong thing? And she said, well, I killed it. She knows. The counsellors told her that she'd be okay. She could just do this thing and move on with her life. And physically, she was okay. But emotionally, she isn't okay. Because we are born with a God consciousness inside of us, and we know right from wrong. And we know when we've done the wrong thing. And we know when God is pricking us about something. We know when the Spirit of God is not giving us any room to move. And that's when we need to do the 1 John 1:9 thing. If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. So we just need to say, God, I'm sorry. I repent of that sin. I don't want to ever do it again because it's blocking my relationship with you. And I love you more than I love my sin. Do you think that woman who broke the alabaster jar before Jesus went out and continued to be a harlot? I doubt it. Because she was so broken before God. She honoured Jesus. She recognised who he was. And I'm sure she made a change to her ways. And what was it that Jesus said to her at the very end? He said, "Your sins are forgiven." And remember, he also told Simon the story about the parable about the two men who had debts. Who's going to be more happy that his debt is cleared? The one that recognises he had the big debt. Now, debt is something we women of the 21st century understand. We all know debt. Mortgages, bank cards, Visa cards, we know debt. Imagine if someone cancelled your debt. Whew, wouldn't that be good? Isn't that what half of the, you know, scratchies and whatever's that you can buy out there are? Everybody's looking to cancel their debt. Well, ladies, the good news is you can cancel your emotional and spiritual debt. You can cancel it. So the stuff that you're sitting there with today that weighs you down, by simply looking to Jesus and asking him, you can go out from here without that debt. Isn't that fabulous? Isn't that worth dancing about? That's what David said. I'm going to dance before the Lord because I don't have to carry that stuff anymore. And Michael, or however you pronounce your name, I don't know how to pronounce it, but anyway, however you pronounce it, I don't care if you're offended at me because before the Lord I'm free and I'm going to go out and live an amazing life. I don't care anymore. I don't care because I know who my God is. And I just want to worship him. And that's what will lead us to freedom. Okay. I want to read you a story. You know how in the Bible there's lots of stories, lots of pictures? I want to read you a story that I picked up, a modern day Bible picture. And it's actually written by Bill Britton, so I'll acknowledge that. And it's a long story, so I apologise for that. But I think it's a story that busy women need to hear. On a dirt road, it's called the King's Carriage. On a dirt road in the middle of a wide field stood a beautiful carriage, something in the order of a stagecoach, but edged in gold with beautiful carvings. It was pulled by six large chestnut horses, two in the lead, two in the middle and two in the rear. Yet they were not moving, not pulling the carriage, and I wondered why. Then I noticed the driver underneath the carriage on the ground on his back, just behind the last two horses' heels, working on something between the front wheels of the carriage, and I thought, my, he's in a dangerous position. For if one of those horses kicked or stepped back, they could kill him. Or if they decided to go forward or somehow got frightened, they would pull the carriage right over. But he didn't seem afraid, for he knew that the horses were disciplined and would not move till he told them. The horses were not stamping their feet, nor acting restless, and though there were bells on their feet, the bells were not tinkling. There were pom-poms on their harnesses over their heads, but the pom-poms were not moving. They simply were standing quietly and still, waiting for the voice of the master. As I watched the harnessed horses, I noticed two young colts in the open field. They approached the carriage and seemed to speak to the harnessed horses. Come, play with us. We have many fine games and we'll race with you. Come, catch us. And with that, the colts kicked up their heels, flicked their tails and raced across the field. But when they looked back, they saw the horses were not following and they were puzzled. They knew nothing of harnesses and did not understand why the horses did not want to play. So they called to them, "Why don't you race with us? Are you tired? Are you too weak? Don't you have strength to run? You are much too solemn. You need more joy in life." But the horses answered not a word, nor did they stamp their feet or toss their heads. Instead, they stood still and quiet, waiting for the voice of the master. Again the colts called to them, "Why do you stand in the hot sun? Come over here in the shade of this nice tree. See how green the grass is. It's so green and tasty. You must be hungry. Come and feed with us. You look thirsty too. Come drink with us." The horses answered not so much as a glance. Suddenly the scene changed. I saw nooses fall round the necks of the two colts and they were led off to the master's corral for training and discipline. How sad they were as the lovely green fields disappeared and they were put into the confinement of the corral with its brown dirt and high fence. The colts ran from fence to fence seeking freedom, but they found they were confined to this place of training, and then the trainer began to work on them with his whip and bridle. What a death for those who had been all their lives accustomed to such a freedom. They could not understand the reason for this torture, this terrible discipline. What crime had they done to deserve this? Little did they know of the responsibility that was to be theirs when they submitted to the discipline, learning to perfectly obey the master and finish their training. All they knew was the process was most horrible. One of the colts rebelled under the training and said, "This isn't for me. I like my freedom, my green hills, my flowing streams of fresh water. I will not take any more of this confinement." And so he found a way, jumped the fence and ran away. I was astonished that the master let him go. He didn't go after him. Instead, he devoted his attention to the remaining colt. This colt, though, had the same opportunity to escape, but he decided to submit his will and learn the ways of the master. The training got harder and harder, but he was rapidly learning more and more how to obey the slightest wish of the master and to respond to even the quietness of his voice. And I saw that had there been no training, no testing, there would have been neither submission nor rebellion from either of the colts. In the field, they did not have the choice of rebelling or submitting. They were sinless in their innocence, but when brought to the place of testing and training and discipline, the obedience of one was manifested and the rebellion of the other also. And though it seemed safer to avoid this place, I saw that without this there could be no sharing of his glory or experiencing of true sonship. Finally, this period of training was over. Was he now rewarded with his freedom and sent back to the field? No, he was brought into a confinement even greater than before, as a harness dropped round his shoulders. Now he found he was not even had the freedom to run about the small corral, for in the harness he could only move where and when the master spoke. Unless the master spoke, he stood still. The scene changed again, and I saw the other colt standing on the side of a hill nibbling at some grass. As he grazed across the fields, he saw the king's carriage coming down the road, drawn by six horses. With amazement, he realised that in the lead on the right side was his brother colt, now made strong and mature on the good corn in the master's stable. He saw the lovely pom-poms shaking in the wind, noticed the glittering gold-bordered harness about his brother, heard the beautiful tinkling of the bells on his feet, and envy came into his heart. And the unharnessed colt complained to himself, "Why has my brother been so honest, while I am neglected? They've not put bells on my feet, nor pom-poms on my head. The master has not given me the wonderful responsibility of pulling his carriage, nor put a gold harness on me. Why have they chosen my brother instead of me?" And by the Spirit the answer came to me as I watched, because one submitted to the discipline of the master and one rebelled. Thus one has been chosen and the other set aside. And then the scene changed and I saw a great drought sweep across the countryside, and the green grass became dead and dry and brown and brittle. The little streams of water stopped flowing and dried up, and there was only a small muddy puddle here and there. I saw the little colt, and I was amazed that he never seemed to grow or mature, and he ran to and fro across the field looking for fresh streams and green pastures and finding none. He seemed to run in circles, always seeming famished in his spirit. But there was famine in the land, and the rich green pastures and flowing streams of yesterday were not to be had. And one day the colt stood on the hillside on weak and wobbly legs, wondering where to go next to find food, and struggling to find strength even to continue his search. It seemed there was no use, for good food and flowing streams were a thing of the past, and all the efforts to find more only taxed his strength. Suddenly, he saw the king's carriage coming down the road, pulled by six majestic horses, and he saw his brother fat and strong, muscles rippling, sleek and beautiful from much grooming. And the colt's heart was amazed, and he cried out, "My brother, where do you find the food to keep you strong and fat in these days of famine? I've run everywhere in my freedom searching for food, and I've found none. Where do you, in your awful confinement, find food in this time of drought? Tell me, for I must know." And the answer came back, "In my master's house, there is a secret place in the confining limitations of his stables, where he feeds me by his own hand. His granaries never run empty and his well never runs dry." With this, the Lord gave me an insight for this day when people are weak and famished in their spirits. Those who have come into the secret place of the Most High, into utter confinement in his will, shall have plenty of corn of heaven and a never-ending flow of fresh streams. from his spirit. Ah, that story really touches my heart. Because do you know what? I think in my nature I'm tempted to be one of those colts out on the hill. I'm tempted to do everything and run and be hither and thither. I love company and people. I love places and things to do. I love to be busy. I love to be out there doing things, experiencing things, tasting everything that is there to be offered. Even in church life, I love all that stuff. I love to be into everything, go to every meeting. You know, I just love all that stuff. And some of it is good stuff, and there's not wrong with all of it. But do you know what God is calling us to as women? He's calling us to be obedient to Him. He's calling us to put Him first above our busyness. He's calling us to be the strong, healthy horses who are fed by His own hand. Women of God who'll be able to face the times in our lives of famine, the times when things aren't so good. He's calling us to sit at His feet. He's calling us to be obedient and self-disciplined. He's calling us to be His. And if we want to run and be frisky and out on the hills and do a million things, He'll let us do it. But then we're going to wake up one day and find we're dried out and shriveled up and our emotional and spiritual and physical energy is gone. And what did Jesus say in John 15? I am the vine and you are the branches, and without me you can do nothing. Oh God, how much nothing have I done in your name? Oh God, I don't want to do nothing for you. I don't want to do the stuff and not be yours ever again. Ever, ever, ever. I want to be one of those women who is strongly linked to the vine, who the living water flows through, and everything she does, as the Proverbs 31 woman, is blessed and honoured because she is the Lord's. That's what I want. That is what God is calling you to today. That's what He's been preparing for months. He's asking you about your heart. And He's asking you if you're committed to take the costly stand and follow Him in whatever pasture He leads you in. We're going to listen in a moment to one more Psalm of David. And while we do that, I want you to shut your eyes and I want you to think about, because God said something really clear to me, really, really clear. The whole time I've carried this message, He said, I don't want this to be about you and your stories. I want this to be about me and commitment. I don't want this just to be one of those conventions where people go and listen and say, oh, that was good. And it made my ears feel good. I want these women to make a commitment to me. I want their hearts. Nothing else will satisfy the Lord. So I want you, in the few minutes we have left, I want you to sit quietly and I want you to shut your eyes and I want you to answer whatever it is God has been asking of you in your heart. If God is asking you to fully commit yourself to Him and to be a woman of God and someone who manages to bring in the peace and the rest of God into your heart, if that's what He's asking you to do, then I want you to talk to Him about that and commit whatever it is that He's put His call on you in this day too. And I also want to say that for some of us that may mean that you need to come out here while the song is playing and you need to just stand before God, because sometimes God requires a response from us. And I'm not saying if you want to be a woman of God, come and stand out here, because then all 250 of us would be out here. Because we all want to be women of God. So you don't have to be embarrassed whether you come out or whether you stay in your seat. Because I can tell you what, I can't see your heart. It's only Jesus who can see your heart. But if Jesus is asking you to make some sort of commitment, some sort of yes, God, from this day on, I'm not going to be that horse out in the field. and I need to get up out of my seat and I need to come down here and I need to either stand or kneel or do whatever I need before you to say, yes, God, this is me. With your grace, I'm going to nail this thing. I'm going to be a woman of God. If you need to do that, then out the front here is open. If you need to just sit quietly in your seat and say, dear God, yep, what you're tugging at my heart with, yep, God, I'll be obedient. I'll forgive that woman. I'll go home and love my husband. I'll say sorry to whatever. I'll do whatever I need to do, God. Then you sit in your chair and do it.